Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, November 11th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, and then Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. Lots of questions. I just drove home. I left Palo Alto on Tuesday, and I was due to have dinner with Franklin. The first thing I did in Tennessee tonight at 6 p.m. Central, I drove into Franklin's house at 5:59, and I said, you know, that's perfect timing. And I must confess, I had a wonderful time in California, but I was homesick. And there's no homecoming better than having dinner with Franklin after you have missed him for the last 2 months. So very, very good to be home and very good to be at Franklin's house and having great dinners at the Sanders house. We're also going to talk tonight about, briefly, Kyle Tiernan's new documentary short, Purchase Local, Surf Global. Kyle's a surfer and just a wonderful person, so that's just a quick note in our Let's Go to the Movies. Well, our theme tonight is hot potato debasement, and what we're talking about is a game of chicken, and in fact a very dangerous game of chicken, going on globally. In the first round, it's really between the Chinese and the Americans, but then it involves everybody. We see it in the squabbling at G20, where literally everybody's trying to push the debasement and the inflation to everyone else as they try and basically get rid of their debt by their monetary policy. And it's really, think of a new system coming into being, and we're having a war between the players as to who gets what lineup in the starting gate, because the guy who can hit the starting gate of the new sort of financial system and the I hate to use the word, the new world order with the inside seats is going to have a lot of advantage. And so there's a game going over about who's going to eat the debt and how. And it's we saw this last week, it get quite heated. Well, Money and Markets, I want to talk about some of the deeper news and deeper stories as opposed to cover everything. The first thing is we're watching the blame game with respect to Obama begin. I had someone ask me today, a very astute commentator, say, you know, do you think that they put Obama in so he could take the blame on what's happening now? And I said, no. I think Obama has served two purposes, the big one being literally to engineer the final piece of the financial coup d'etat. You'd issued trillions of dollars of fraudulent securities to do what we've done, including the housing bubble. And the question was, who was, and this is part of the hot potato game, who's gonna eat that debt? And what Obama was basically able to engineer, both as a senator using his credibility as a candidate to support the Bush administration and then as president, was basically able to engineer the taxpayers assuming responsibility for all the phony paper, including the paper of the European debts, but probably not including the paper that's sitting in our pension fund. So we literally watched a bailout, $12 trillion and up, depending on whose estimate you see. And frankly, it was one of the most astounding political feats in the history of the world, because you have our first African-American president getting that community and many communities of progressives who've absolutely been harmed by this process support the reengineering out of the debt and the assumption of it. So it was an incredible political feat, and the question is, you know, are they through with Obama? We're starting to see after the election tremendous sort of let's blame Obama, this is his fault. The shape that we're in, the economy is his fault. I think there's more that they can get done with this administration, so it's a little bit early to play the blame game, but it's clear that that's where this is going. And of course, anybody who really understands the deeper economy knows that this issue is much deeper than the president. The president doesn't have the control. But what I will say is, as a front man, Obama has done an incredible job of basically making the financial coup d'etat a fait accompli. In the process of this game of politics in the United States, we also see a real missed opportunity. There's tremendous anger and sadness in the progressive community for, quote-unquote, the triumph of the Tea Party, and great offense. And what you're really seeing is the divide-and-conquer politics play out, the people who really started the Tea Party movement and the real grassroots are still not conversing with their equivalents in other sectors of the political spectrum. And that's where the conversation needs to happen. So we've literally watched the Tea Party thing be engineered to continue the divide and conquer, and it's too bad. Because if you go to the Tea Party meetings and you meet the people, or if you go to the progressive meetings and you meet the people, there's a tremendous amount of alignment between them if they could only meet and stop trying to judge each other through the media. I know I used to say when I first got to Hardeman County, because there's great racial tension in Hardeman County, and I used to say to people, you know, if you would just collaborate about the money, you could hate each other rich instead of hating each other poor. And you could say that about any of the different cuts of divide and conquer, because this really is about centralization versus decentralization. So don't fall into that trap no matter what part of the political spectrum you're in. Reach out and touch someone and start having an intimate conversation on the decentralization team. Another theme I just want to mention, I'll call Waiting for Godot. We had a wonderful interview last month with Nora Gagaudis from Oregon, who in her practice as a neural feedback practitioner has found that we are all in a state of permanent fight or flight. And I very much equate that to the kinds of calls I get day to day from clients or subscribers who are terrified of some new horrible prediction about how the end of the world is going to come. And I've noticed in the questions that we're getting at the Solari Report real concern about different predictions of collapse and a variety of different scenarios. And I would just really encourage everyone to remember there's nothing more that the people who are centralizing the economy would love is for us to be in a state of fear and sort of give up on building the future and instead sit around and be entertained by the next prediction of collapse. So I really want to encourage everyone not to sit around and wait for Godot or wait for the kaboom, but turtle forward, because what we're watching, and I saw this a lot in California, is more and more people saying, you know, this system makes no sense. We're going to move forward. And what you're seeing is people have spent the last 5 to 10 years really trying to build something that makes sense for the future in very good positions, despite the deterioration in the environment. I had a wonderful person in our network say to me today, you know, I was really glad that silver got knocked down. And I started to question him, and I think intuitively what he was feeling was the danger that in this kind of environment traditionally that tensions of the kind we're seeing internationally don't necessarily get satisfied by price. They get satisfied by warfare. And the danger is if the financial markets shift too much too fast, we could start to see both the covert and overt violence. A couple of important stories to point out. The President's Bipartisan Commission on Reducing the Deficit came out Wednesday with a series of proposals that I call being in a fake box or a fake framework. And this fake framework is going to come at all of us hard and fast now. So I want you to be just be ready intellectually to see it for what it is. They're basically saying that if we do deep cuts in both domestic and military spending, we increase the gas tax 15 cents a gallon, we limit tax breaks, and then remember what John Laughlin said last week about backing up the age on retirement in France, increase the age for Social Security, so not cut benefits, but increase the age. Now, what you and I know is the Fed is engaging in QE2 and other policies of qualitative easing. They are cutting Social Security benefits. Now, the Commission says that all of this is going to erase $4 trillion of deficits. Well, $4 trillion is a magic number for me because that's the amount of money I was able to document went missing from the federal government. And so let's break out of the fake box. If we had $12 trillion for bailouts and there's $4 trillion missing from the federal government, and all of these things are what we need to cut $4 trillion off the deficit, then what I say is, well, I think it's time we looked at where that $4 trillion went and get it back. And the reason I say that, because people say, oh, it's hopeless to get it back, it's really not hopeless. There's no point in putting milk in a milk bucket if there's a hole in the bottom. So before you make the kind of cuts to put more milk in the milk bottle, we need to address the question of why is there a hole in the bottom and where does all this milk keep going? You know, it's pouring out of the floor. Another interesting story that's up on the blog is federal compensation. Federal workers, according to USA Today, the number of federal workers being paid $150,000 or more is increased 10 times in the past 5 years. It's doubled since Obama's been the president. He approved a 1.4% pay hike for 2.1 million federal workers, although did a bonus freeze on the political appointees of almost 3,000 people. What you're seeing now is federal workers being paid significantly more than the private sector workers who are paying the taxes to pay their salary. That has very serious implications for governance in the United States, because what it means is you're now talking about people who are aligned from their compensation more as enforcers, as really public servants serving the public good. Okay, robo-signing. We see more awareness about what's really been going on. I put up two unbelievable depositions from a law firm in Florida that had two people who work on a title company who admitted that they were signing significant numbers of documents as vice presidents of J.P. Morgan Chase, of Citibank, of Wells Fargo, of all the big banks. Now, this is a criminal omission. I mean, it's just mind-boggling if you know anything about sort of integrity of documentations, et cetera. We also have a very interesting editorial coming out of Boston saying the prison boom is over and basically pointing out all the things that I was writing about in the 90s and which I described in the Dylan Reed and Aristocracy of Stock Profits, you know, basically that if you look at prison on a per-person basis, it's financially insane, and, of course, now we can't afford it. So more and more dawning of the sort of fundamental economics in the system as the government money shrinks. The shrinkage of state and local government continues to be as important and profound as we've talked about on the Solari Report. We have California just announcing that they've got another $25 billion hole, and that's after the round of cuts they did to come up with this year's budget. I know before I left California, I had wonderful people working in hospitals and different organizations receiving significant amount of state and federal budgets. And if you look at the cutbacks that they're having to deal with, I mean, we're really talking about fundamental reinvention of their operations. So there's a lot to be worked through in the economy, and this transition is very far from over. And the question for all of us is, you know, how is it going to be resolved? Because we're watching financially a pig go through a snake, and overhead globally built for a bubble having to downsize, and everybody competing as to who's going to pick up the debt and, you know, who's going to be the winner and loser. And that is really a global game. And, of course, at the heart of that global game is gold and silver. And so what we're watching in the price of gold and silver is very much an indicator and a tool within that. So, Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
You know, I can't tell you how good it was to see you tonight. This is my Tennessee homecoming. So a lot has gone on in the last 2 weeks, and we've all been burning to hear you both describe what's happened in the market and sort of the deeper story behind it. So why don't you just weigh it in?
Well, first of all, you know, everybody ought to understand that what we've seen in the last couple of months in the gold and silver market is not normal. Days when you get 160 cents or 140 cents up in the silver market, those are not normal days. Those are days that we have not seen since late 1979 when silver was blowing off to $50. So that is the result of two things. First of all, it's the result of Bernanke's quantitative easing announcements and all of these people in the world who are suddenly waking up and going, wait a minute, I have to get out of dollars. I've got to do something, and running into silver and gold. And then another part of it, though, and this is the important part that you must not miss, the other part of it is that is what a bull market looks like.
Right.
It goes up, it climbs a wall of worry, and you can think of a million reasons why this is not possible, and yet it advances day after day after day. So that's what we've seen. The market broke a few days ago and last week, actually, and a lot of people think, well, the margin requirements were changed by COMEX, and that's what broke the market. That is not what broke the market. The market was way, way overbought, and any catalyst would have surprised any you know, government announcement, whatever, that was a little bit unexpected. So the COMEX margin change really ought to be viewed just as a catalyst and not anything more than that.
Right, but to me, it's a good reminder that if they want to dampen, you know, if the people governing and managing the exchanges and the markets and the central bank want to dampen things, they have a remarkable number of tools in their toolkit to do so.
Well, yes, and it's a reminder of something else, too, and that is that the people on the COMEX do not rule the market for the public's benefit. They rule it for their own benefit.
Right.
I mean, that whenever any market heats up, they will change the market margin requirements because they want the market to be orderly so that their profits are orderly. And it's just that simple. The thing that's happened is that the dollar appears to have turned around. And if you look at say a 6-month chart of the dollar, you'll see that there's a W formation or a double bottom formation. And if the dollar gets through about, 78, 75 or so, the dollar index, then it will go higher and it'll probably go to 80 or so. I think the one thing that the overwhelming conclusion that you need to come away with from the events of the last month or 2 months is that the Obama administration, together with the Fed, have made a decision to solve their problems by depreciating the dollar.
Right.
And you have to go back and remember that during the Great Depression, Roosevelt, although he did it over the course of a year, depreciated the dollar by 41%. Well, that's what it means that they dropped the gold content of the dollar from $20.67 to the ounce to $35 to the ounce. They reduced the gold content of the dollar by 41%. They devalued it by 41%. Now, clearly what Bernanke has in mind is to do the same thing, maybe 25% in 6 months, maybe more than that. But clearly, they are letting the market drop. But for right now, just as a temporary matter to keep things orderly from their standpoint, they're going to let the dollar run up to, say, 80 or so. And that will scare out, that will shake out all of the shorts. That will keep the whole market confused and bewildered enough that they can continue to manipulate it and continue to drop the dollar's exchange rate. That has had a big effect on silver and gold. I don't think it's a permanent effect. You have to be careful. I have to be careful when I say these things not to leave the wrong impression. A rising dollar obviously is not good for silver and gold. But if you look at the price of gold in yen, if you look at the price of gold in euros, you'll see that it's rising across the board. So what has happened is that gold and silver have become the prime alternative currencies. Now, turning to gold and silver real quickly, what you see is that there's sort of a contradiction or a non-confirmation in the charts, and I'm working on real short-term charts here, 5-day charts. But the 5-day chart in gold has recovered from the fall that really occurred mostly on Tuesday. It's recovered.
I've been stunned at how fast it's recovered.
Well, I know, and that's a little questionable to me. I'm not sure that that's believable because remember that the recovery wave, after you have a big drop, the recovery wave is often stronger than a garlic milkshake. It's that, you get an ABC correction. That is, you go down an A leg, up a B leg, and down a C leg. And that B wave is stronger a lot of times than the preceding up wave. What happens is, though, it sucks you in, and then you get a C wave that's really, really strong. Now, I can't say yet that silver and gold have finished their correction, and the reason for that is because gold would have to close above 1424.50, and silver would have to close above 2930 to prove that they have left that behind. And I think if we're gonna have a down day, it's gonna happen tomorrow or the next day. Now, all of these things, let's put it back off and put it in perspective again, all of these things are happening in the course of an advance in gold from $1,050 to $1,600. And that's a very firm target in my mind. Call that 1575, 1625. But it's in that area somewhere. And we are in an advance right now that probably will top in January or February that will carry gold to that level and silver to $34 to maybe $40 an ounce.
Now, one of the questions we got is, let me just read it to you, as the price of gold has been historically high in December, would you wait until January to buy?
No, because the cyclical highs tend to occur either in January, February, or March. So by cyclical highs, what I mean is when you have an advance like the one we're coming out of, where gold has been advancing for more than 12 months, then those highs during this bull market have occurred almost exclusively. In fact, they have occurred exclusively in January, February, and March. So, you know, at the end of the year, gold is usually rising into December. It's normal for gold. Well, when I say normal, I'd say, you know, 7/8 of the time, it finishes December, the end of December, higher than it began. So you're going to see higher prices probably into January or early part of next year.
Well, one of the things we really want to talk tonight about is trading the gold-silver ratio, because it was looking, before silver backed up, it was looking like we were getting close.
We did get close.
We did get close. So let's talk about, first of all, what is trading the gold-silver ratio? And then, of course, the big question is, when should we get ready to trade, and then how do we do it?
Well, let me try to give you a conceptual framework for what we're talking about. You know, when in a bull market, markets go up and down, they zig and they zag. And one of the rules for trading a bull market is you don't try to trade in and out. You don't try to sell the highs and buy the lows because it's simply too unpredictable for that. You can't do that successfully. But if we have two markets that are in a primary uptrend, a bull market, and one of them moves faster than the other as silver moves faster than gold, then we can swap from one to the other and actually capture those differences without ever being out of the market. So that's what trading the gold-silver ratio does for us. We swap silver for gold whenever the ratio makes gold cheap relative to silver, and then we reverse it when silver becomes cheap relative to gold. And so we were looking for a ratio of 47-1. That is, it took, 47.5-1. That is where it took 47.5 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold.
Now, I should just step back. Historically, according to James Turk, he said you should sell all your gold and silver when the gold-silver ratio is 15.
Absolutely.
That says you've peaked.
That's right.
And so we've been as high this year as 74.
Yes.
Okay. And now we're at 51.
Right.
We dipped down through 50. We started to earlier. And now how do we know if we trade at 47, how do we know it won't keep just dropping towards 15?
Well, the real truth is we don't.
We don't.
We did. What we can bet is that it probably won't go lower than 43. Or maybe 41 at the most. And I know that that's leaving 20 or 16% laying on the table. But that's not so bad, because if you think about it, we bought silver when the ratio was anywhere from 74 down to, you know,
right,
60. So we've got a huge gain in that. And then we'll get the opportunity when the reaction comes to go back into silver at a ratio probably of about 57 to 1. So, I look at the ratio. I'm trying to determine whether I should change that target, and there's a remote possibility that I might lower the target. But one of the things, Catherine, that you know about trading is you have to make a rule and a target for yourself.
Right.
And if you don't trade when it hits, then greed and fear will always overcome you and defeat you. It's just that simple.
One of my favorite lines, I love baseball, is Ted Williams was famous for never hitting outside of the strike zone. And a reporter kept bugging him and saying, come on, you know, you must swing outside the strike zone. And he said, no, I never do. I never swing outside the strike zone. And the reporter said, why? And he said, he turned to him and he said, but then how would I know where to draw the line?
Exactly.
Well, one of the things that makes trading, people are reluctant to trade is, and I'm going to talk about this a little more because we've been grappling with this in terms of switching from unallocated to allocated accounts. If we're outside of an IRA, if we're in the IRA, then we don't have to worry about the taxes for now. But if we're outside the IRA, it means, you know, if I'm trading from silver to gold, then I'm going to have to pay taxes on my silver position. And if I bought silver at 8, you know, I've got 28% on a big gain. And so that's going to take a little wind out of the sails.
Well, okay, this is true, but let me ask you a question. If you have the opportunity to make a 30% profit, and you know that the locusts who call themselves the United States government are going to steal a third of that, are you going to walk away from the profit because they're going to get a third and you're only going to get two-thirds?
I'm not.
Well, I wouldn't either, and that's the point I'm trying to make. You see, you know, you and I talked about this before, that in 1945, Beardsley Rummel, who was then head of the New York Federal Reserve, made a speech before the American Bar Association in which he said, taxes for revenue are dead. The only purpose that taxes serve is to control behavior. That's it.
Right.
And you have to ask yourself this question. They've laid this tax to control my behavior. Is it in my interest to do what they want me to do? And if it's not in your interest, then you have to do something else. But tax consequences are not the only determinant of any trade.
Well, the other thing also, the way I feel, is that a portion of the unrealized gains are never mine anyway, and I need to not think of them as mine. You know, and that's just the nature of the system I'm functioning in.
Of course, yeah.
So I don't want to get tricked by the illusion of something being mine. Okay, now how do we do it? If we want to trade the gold-silver ratio, how do we do it?
Could I back up a minute and
sure.
Address this tax thing? Just 1 minute. When you have a gain, there are two different ways of interpreting that gain. There's one is that it's a gain on collectibles. The other is that it's just a capital gain. And I have talked to accountants who do commodity futures trading accounting, and I get different opinions from all of them.
Yep.
So when I get different opinions, I don't do the most conservative thing. I do my thing. And but I admit, you know, I'm a kamikaze. I'm not trying to convince anybody to do that. The second thing to consider here is when we make it, let's say we do a swap from silver into gold and we've got a big profit on the silver. In 4 to 12 weeks, we're going to go back the other way.
Maybe.
No. Most surely we will go back. Within 12 weeks, we'll go back. That's just the way, that's the dynamic of the market. That's the way it works. And when that happens, we're going to sell the gold and buy silver. And at that point, we always have a loss in the gold, and that loss in the gold helps to offset the gain in the silver.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that it will wholly offset it, but it helps to offset it. So, you know, you've got a gain on one, a loss on the other, and the one helps to offset the other. So, it's not, you know, the tax consequences are not the end of the world, and the trade is rich enough to bear those costs anyway.
Right. It's I'm continually amazed by how much taxes can get in the way of fundamental economics. One of the things I wanted to mention, and I put this up on the blog, Franklin, is we've been looking in great detail at what are the tax issues of moving from a non-allocated account into an allocated account. Let me just explain. We've seen all sorts of investors buy into pools, like the kind of pools you have at Perth Mint or Kitco, or, you know, there are a variety of them where you're holding something that's not allocated. So you go to a bank, and instead of buying the actual bullion or coins and put them in your safe deposit box, you're just holding them in the bank's pool. And, of course, what we're seeing is the prices go up, and there's greater concern about, you know, is the gold really there or is the silver really there? People are saying, well, wait a minute, I want to move to an allocated, and the question is, do I do that in a way that's taxable or not? And it was interesting, as we sorted through this, it was the same. You're working with CPAs, and different people have different positions. And so I finally decided to ask our attorney to help me collect up and put into one unbelievably long and complex document all the internal revenue rulings and directions that might inform different kinds of exchanges of precious metals. And it's our feeling that if something is going from gold to gold or silver to silver, and you're paying the fabrication fee and moving it out of an allocated, moving it out of an unallocated, but taking delivery by, you know, whether it's paying the fabrication or being there and taking delivery, that it's not a taxable because you're simply taking your precious metals and you're moving them from one place to another place.
Right, so like an exchange.
Right, but it, you know, there's no exact ruling on that exact point. So it was very important to us to collect up all the information and make it available so that your own CPA could, you know, because ultimately at the end of the day, I think what's important is that, you know, whoever's doing this for you is prepared to back it up. And the idea is we wanted to make it possible for them to figure it out in 2 hours instead of 150.
And substantially reduce the cost.
It's unbelievably arcane because I think if most investors took this to most CPAs, you know, the bill would be $10,000 for them to really research it. So our hope was that this would make it much easier. And this is for now. This is available to subscribers only. We'll publish it more widely, but I wanted to make sure subscribers had time with it. Okay, so how soon do we think we could? You think we could get to 47? Do you think it's...
Well, let me just go back and tell you that when this week we got the ratio to about 48.3, and it turned there instead of going on to 47.5. It is not clear to me by any means which way silver and gold are going to go from here, whether we're going to get a more extended correction and a reaction of the ratio up to, say, 57 or so before we go further down. And there's a reason for me to think that there's a lower target on the chart. But you're going to get that bottom by the middle of January, maybe February latest. Everything that I'm looking at points to that, you know, a date fairly early next year. And, you know, exogenous things, outward things might make a difference. The Fed might make an announcement, oh, we're not going to buy but $300 billion instead of $600 billion in Treasury bills or something like that. But basically, we've got this target, we've got a timetable, and the market's moving to its own internal timetable. So if I could do a trade at 47.5 to 1, frankly, I would be happy. And then we will, as I said, within 4 to 12 weeks, we will get the opportunity to go back into silver. And at that point, you know, we'll go back into silver. But if anybody has been thinking about doing this trade, they absolutely must talk to their gold and silver broker now.
And get the order in now.
Oh, get an open order in. Yeah, because it just can't, Catherine, it simply can't be done. That when it happens very, very
fast.
Yeah,
it's like lightning.
Yeah.
So it's very important to explain. An open order is when you, it's like putting a limit order in a brokerage account. In other words, you authorize the trade to be done when the ratio hits at a certain point.
Right, and nobody calls you and says, hey, do you still want to do this? It's just entered.
Yeah, you've authorized it, and it's mm-hmm. going to happen.
Right.
Okay, so put in your open order now. I just wanted to mention, you know, in the securities market, when you think we're going to come back that fast, we call that a round trip.
When we will come back to?
In other words, if you expect in that shorter period to come back into silver,
mm-hmm.
then you're planning on a round trip.
Right, and that will happen by, well, you know, if it's in January, it won't be any later than end of April.
Now, we got another question that says the swap results in capital gains. Is that an issue? And just to confirm again, if you are swapping at a valuation for your silver, which is higher than where you bought it, including your all expenses in the purchase, yes, you've got a capital gain.
You know, here's one of the things I don't understand, Catherine.
I
will argue with the government about principle.
Uh-huh.
All right? I've done it. I mean, you know, I'll go all the way to the mat with them, and if it kills me, I'm not going to give up the principle. But I will not argue with them about money, and I'm certainly not going to lie to them about money.
Right.
Because you signed that tax return under penalty of perjury. Why in the world would you make yourself a liar and bring all that criminal liability on yourself?
Well, the pain in all of this, if you go back to the charts that we have in Position Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, and that audio seminar is linked to all subscribers have links to all the audio seminars in the first entry in your cart. What it shows is between 2003 and 2008, a $10,000 of investment in a CD or fixed income, literally in a five-year period, Franklin lost half of its purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
If we put it in gold or precious metals, whether it's, you know, a balance of gold and silver gold, we ended up, after paying taxes at the end of the period, having the same purchasing power when priced in gallons of gasoline. So we held our purchasing power. So basically, if you look at what they're doing, they're taxing away all of your gain, and in some instances, they're taxing away your principal because you're basically paying taxes on a debased currency. And
right.
So, and that's, I think, what's so frustrating for people, because we're trying at the best, you know, at the least, to hold our purchasing power, and so paying the taxes can be very frustrating because it's another way they make money on inflation.
Well, sure, but the thing is, we just have to make the best of the hand that's dealt us.
Right.
We don't get four aces every time. You know, and so.
But I can dream of that.
Yeah, I know, but if I've got a full house, we're going to play the full house.
Right, know? Exactly. Okay, another question. The margins affect the retail, not the commercials, correct?
No, yes, that's true, because if you're commercial, you've got a different ratio requirement, and I really can't answer that question because usually the commercial margins are not raised because the assumption is that if a person is selling silver futures, for example, he's buying physicals, and so he deserves a smaller margin because he's not undertaking the same risk as the person who buys, for instance, a naked short.
Well, one of the reasons I believe they changed the margin requirements was the fear that all that silver exposure was going to come in demanding gold. I mean, think about it. How much gold are they going to have to come up with if everybody trades? Do you see anybody?
Well, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, but think about it. They'd have to share a lot of gold.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
But do you remember you probably weren't involved in the gold and silver market in 1980, but I was.
Oh, and I watched it.
Well, you remember what happened?
Yeah.
They had a market that was running away. It was not Hunt that was doing it to them, because Hunt had arranged already in September before that to take what was called exchange of futures for physicals, and to take silver that was not as good as what he was entitled to in exchange for physicals, for futures contracts that he held. So he was trying to take the pressure off the market. But when the people who run the market got squeezed, then they nailed the public. And they cut off trading in new contracts and so forth. They raised the margin requirements first. You know, they raised them to like $20,000. It was ridiculous. But the markets are not run for the benefit of the public. They're run for the benefit of the market makers.
Right.
And you have to, this is one of the reasons, Catherine, that I won't buy futures. Because just as sure as you're beating the market makers, they're going to turn around and figure out a way to cheat you.
Right. If you're long in the long-term trend, you're fine, no matter which way it's bouncing around.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, you can get... I mean, that's my problem with stop orders, because you get a flash crash, they sell you out, and then if the price flies back up, and you're slaughtered.
Right. And that's the reason why I'd rather be in
right.
physicals. Yeah.
Okay. So let's turn to the bigger picture, because we saw a remarkable trial balloon. And I know you and I have talked before about the Bill Clinton trial balloon of sort of dangling out the gold standard and what went wrong when we went off the gold standard. But we had a remarkable trial balloon this week, and maybe if we could turn to that and you could address what in the world happened with the World Bank president at G20.
Well, the word World Bank president is an apparatchik named Robert Selleck, and he's worked for the Treasury for years and years. And he, right on the eve of this G20 meeting, which I think takes place in Korea, he publishes an article in the London Financial Times, which, of course, everybody in the business and financial world reads. And then the title of the article was "The G20 Must Look Beyond Bretton Woods Too." Now, the article was 15 paragraphs or so, and most of it did not have to do with gold or anything else. It had to do with the usual bureaucratic talks about how we're going to level out the global economy and this sort of stuff. But this paragraph appeared, and I'd like to read this paragraph verbatim. He said way down the article, paragraph 13, "The system should also consider employing gold as an international reference point of market expectation about inflation, deflation, and future currency values. Although textbooks may view gold as the old money, markets are using gold as an alternative monetary asset today." And then further, he said this in the next paragraph, "The development of a monetary system to succeed, Bretton Woods II, launched in 1971, that is the floating exchange rate regime, will take time, but we need to begin. The scope of the changes since 1971 certainly matches those between 45 and 71 that prompted the shift from Bretton Woods 1 to 2. Serious work should include possible changes in International Monetary Fund rules to review capital as well as current accounts policies and connect IMF monetary assessments with world trade obligations, and not to use currency policies to remove trade concessions." Trade concessions. And that's the end of the quote. Now, that's a lot of bureaucratic smoke is what that is. But what he's saying basically is, look, face the facts. We've got to bring gold back into the system because the market is already using it as the measure of inflation, deflation, and economic expectations. And then secondly, he says, the system of floating exchange rates has become an intense embarrassment. It does not work, and it threatens to blow everything apart in a round of currency devaluations, you know, competitive currency devaluations. And so we've got to do something about this. But he's also saying this is not going to happen soon. This is going to take a long time. But the very fact that this person would say this after the World Bank, the IMF, and everybody else who swings any kind of bureaucratic rod for the last 50 years has said, oh, don't worry about gold, that doesn't count anymore. Clearly, this is a huge message that says someone in the establishment wants gold back in the system and intends to put it back in the system
right.
at some time in the distant future.
Right. Well, that, you know, ever since you and I met and I sort of told you my vision on this thing, it always struck me from the beginning of learning about gold in the late 90s that if you what was happening globally was the people centralizing the economy were literally shifting assets out of government and into private hands at below market prices. Mm-hmm. And so when you suppress gold, why should they be doing anything different? And what I've always said is, well, you know, yes, J.P. Morgan Chase may be short, but if they are, that short probably is a U.S. government short. And if you look at who owns them, basically they're long by a lot. And, you know, a short plus a long can equal a big long. So it seems to me that, you know, I've said this many times, if you're gonna use fiat currency to basically get control of everything, or to buy up all the real assets, once you do, the last thing you want to do is keep going with a fiat currency, because in fact you want a real currency to protect your holdings now.
Well, that's right.
Right.
And let me go back and put some flesh on those bones that you laid out there. You remember how all of these countries had nationalized industries and they sold off the nationalized industries? You remember
right.
they had electric companies and this railroad companies, all this stuff. And this happened in Russia. It happened in South America. It happened in Europe and all these other places. And this so-called privatization transferred massive public assets to private hands.
At below market prices.
At below market prices.
Right.
That's exactly right. And it simply makes sense to view what happened in the gold market as the same thing.
Exactly.
They kept the price down artificially low for a long period of time, which gave the people in the know the ability to accumulate massive amounts of gold at below market rates. Very simple.
Right, and the funny thing is that in some respects, where they're going is in alignment with where we'd like to go, in the sense that I'd like to see a currency that is an honest communication device in the real economy, because that's what can make the real economy grow. And it kind of irritates me. But in fact, if you look at how much wealth can be created, we need to go there.
Right.
And so if you look at where they're, you know, now that they've stolen all the money, they're standing up and saying, well, let's be responsible. And but in fact, you know, if you and I were sitting there, we'd want to do the same thing.
Certainly.
Yeah. So it's what I've always said to people is, you know, unfortunately, the politics are with us.
Right. Well, one of the most important things that you have to do in scoping these things out, and it's not easy. I don't mean to, you know, I don't mean to be cavalier or you know, light-minded and say, well, this is very easy. But what you have to do is to be a good soldier. And that means you have to creep into the mind of your enemy and say, what is the enemy going to do? If I were the enemy, what would be the cleverest thing I could do? And when you begin to do that, then you see behind these movements, and just like in suppressing the gold price, well, sure, one of the purposes was to suppress the interest rate, and the gold price was a means to that end. But also, it was a massive transfer of public assets into private hands at below market rates. And now that they, if that's true and they're in that position, then the next thing they're going to do is to end the fiat money system and put gold back into the system. Although, I want to make very clear, we're talking about numerous years down the road.
Right.
This is not going to happen tomorrow.
This is a long, slow process.
Oh, absolutely.
This is part of the slow burn.
That's right. There you go.
There were two things I wanted to mention very quickly while we're on the subject of trial balloons from scallywags. Alan Greenspan was at the Jekyll Island. Can you believe they had a celebration at Jekyll Island? 100-year anniversary of the – was it 100-year anniversary of the –
That's about right.
Yeah.
It's close to 100 years.
It's close to 100. Well, the meeting in Jekyll Island, maybe they were celebrating the conspiracy. But Greenspan stood up and, to Bernanke's distress, started talking about we needed more enforcement and mortgage fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could have just gone through the floor, because I've never seen I have never seen more chutzpah in my life. Now, every time I say that about Greenspan, he does something that, you know, is even more galactic in its hypocrisy. But this was the man who literally in 1998, to help shut Maxine Waters up about CIA narcotics trafficking in L.A., you know, went to her district and walked around and handed out more HUD grants. So, you know, the idea that he says the problem was we really weren't enforcing the law, it's just unbelievable. So I wanted to point that out. A second thing, and we have some questions about this as well, where I would say that if your goal in life was simply to make money, that the most profitable job in the economy this year is to be the lead law firm for JPMorgan Chase. Because if you look at the lawsuits that are piling on, we'll go back, the strong dollar policy, the two of the key pillars, one was the suppression of the gold price and the other was the mortgage and debt bubble, and in both areas we're watching lawsuits galore. It's just, you know, it's unbelievable, and we have a question about the lawsuits. There's a theory that keeps running around thinking that one more lawsuit is somehow going to bust JPMorgan Chase. And, you know, this is something I don't understand, Franklin, and maybe you can help me because, of course, you know, JPMorgan Chase is the lead bank for the New York Fed, which is the lead bank for the U.S. government, including the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And the reality is we're looking at a machinery that has the power to just create money out of thin air. Why would they ever default? They can't default. In other words, their obligation to the creditor is in a commodity that they can create out of thin air.
Precisely.
How could you ever default?
You can't. That's the reason why they want cash settlement for gold and silver futures contracts.
Right.
Because if you can settle in cash, then you can't possibly be put into a short squeeze, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, right. You know, this is another thing is the naivete of believing that some critical key lawsuit will blow the whole thing up, because does anybody think that if J.P. Morgan or Chase or any of those people are acting as the agent for the United States government, that they don't have air cover from the Fed with whatever judge they need to have air cover with? I mean, it's like the Bay of Pigs, right? Everybody knows why the Bay of Pigs was not a successful invasion. It was because they sent in all these Cuban patriots to hit the beach, and they had no air cover. Well, I guarantee you, J.P. Morgan or any of these people that act as the agent for government, they know that they're going to get cover if they get taken to court. And, you know, the worst presupposition in this naive idea is that the courts are square.
Well, look at the story this week. Goldman Sachs, we have a former Goldman Sachs trader was using proprietary software, is going to trial. The Department of Justice, on behalf of the U.S. government, filed a motion this week saying that the trial needs to be under seal because the proprietary secrets can't come out. So you have the Department of Justice and the court system twisting itself upside down to protect Goldman Sachs' secrets on how they manipulate the market. That's extraordinary.
Right, but you've heard of the Sherman Antitrust Act, right?
I have, but the Department of Justice apparently
has. Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. What you see is that the court system is, there's not a system of equal justice before the law in the United States. And you know by bitter experience, and I know by bitter experience, that when some people go into court, the special rules are applied to them. And the special rules may work against you, or they may work for you. But the special rules are there, and they will be applied. And so that's the reason why, I mean, it's true that these things can create a little bit of heat, but they're not going to create an explosion.
Right.
They'll never burst into that.
Well, it seems to me across all the markets, across all the parts of our lives, across all the state and local and federal and global politics, what we're seeing is what you and I have always said, which is the real economy will be heard from one way or another. In other words, you can hide in a bubble, but at some point things have to come back to ground. And we're literally getting that message even from Greenspan and the head of the World Bank, you know, we're planning on bringing it back to ground.
Well, it's the Midianite. I think with Greenspan, it's the Midianite. You know, there is no honor among thieves. And if you put enough heat on the thief, he'll break and betray his brothers. But you're exactly right. You know, eventually reality always revenges itself. That's just the way it is. And
yeah.
You know, the economy, the real world comes back to what are the things that men take out of the ground? What are the things that men produce? And
that's why I want everyone in this call to don't worry about the big kaboom. Get into building a real, you know, repositioning your life for a life that's successful in alignment with a real economy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's we got to get going. Okay, well, Franklin, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for another great precious metals market report. Very quickly, I just wanted to mention, and let's go to the movies, Kyle Tiernan has put out a new little short video. It's up on the blog, and you can get it. His website is called Purchase Local and Surf Global. And Kyle is a marvelous young man. He's in college and also just a global surfer at competing at a, you know, not that I understand that world, but a major level. And he's done a really good job of helping me understand the importance of slowing down and explaining some of these ideas. He did a little short on banking local that was really wonderful. We had it up on the blog, and now he's done this on the importance of circulating your money locally. It's something I know you've heard Franklin's speeches that I put up on the blog, or you've heard us talk about it, but it's real important. He gets Annie Leonard, who did that wonderful little video on the importance of stuff, and interviews her, and it's a wonderful thing to just spread to your friends and family to help them understand the power of shifting our money and of really sitting down and looking at, okay, where do I put my time, my attention, my money, and how can I start to shift that in a way that's going to build up the local economy? And one of the things Kyle does a great job of pointing out is the importance of that if we're going to create new jobs. And everywhere, it was amazing as I drove back from California. Every time I think the rural areas can't be drained anymore, I'm just stunned to see. You know, Franklin, this is a terrible thing. I'm now stopping and staying at motels I've stayed at before. I've eaten at this restaurant before. Oh, my. And, you know, the pain is extraordinary because so many of these communities continue to be on dollars. These communities just switched to gold and silver, you know, and much more barter and much more local. There's so much that could be done, but we're all stuck on the, you know, on the paper money treadmill, and it's very frightening. I just wanted to mention my hero of the week as I crossed Arizona was there was a large field rancher clearly running livestock, and he had built a billboard, huge white billboard with wood columns, and the whole thing was white, and on it had the URL very simply in black paint, AE911truth.org. I said, no, that's a rancher who's in trouble with his wife, but, you know, he's changing the world because I can't tell you how many people see that URL. And, you know, you watch it as you're driving up, so you're watching it for about a mile, and it's really imprinted in your head. So, you know, it just goes to show you the revolutionary is everywhere. Okay, so coming up next week, Axel Merck of the Merck Funds. On the international fixed income markets, there's a lot going on there, and sorting out the solid credits from the not solid credits is a pretty tricky business, and also seeing the sort of the currency wars. Axel is just a marvelous person who's really dedicated his life. He's got a book called Sustainable Wealth. I'll be reviewing that as well. Then on December 2nd, Charles Murray, the president of American Institute for Economic Research up in Massachusetts. It's a wonderful organization that does economic research and financial planning. Great tools if you're going to buy a car. If you go to their bookstore, they just have great products. And the one I want to focus is If Something Should Happen, which is a wonderful little manual to help you get your records and sort of financial house and legal house in order in case there should be an accident or a disaster. It's just a great planning tool. then, of course, you know, what happens next? December, we come back, Franklin, to see what's happened to the gold-silver ratio and talking with you. So remember, David Lichty, Paul Ferguson, and I are also at Solari Silver and Gold. We're here to help and make sure you protect yourself against the currency debasement underway. Franklin's at the Money Changer. We love to hear from you. So until next week with Axel Merck, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you absolutely have to start one. Good night and good luck.